Check. Thanks so much. We'll be starting off with the next session, but two quick announcements. The first one is the Cloud Unconference event I was talking about. Mark, I'm going to quickly switch you back to the podium PC there. We have the Cloud Unconference event happening right after this. After this event, it's at 5:30, and it'll be in the building behind. There's a Mayuri restaurant, and we'll be having the Unconference event there. That is not Windows Azure specific. It's platform agnostic. So if you want to learn about AWS, you want to talk about Rackspace, you want to talk about Azure, or anything from this event, please feel free to come join us at that event. That one is organized by Northwest Cloud, which is a local user group that is just starting. You might want to be a part of that user group as well. Registration details will be provided at that event for joining the user group. The second announcement is we have tons of awesome stuff here to raffle. I have a flip camera, Zune HD player, keyboard, and a netbook, and all of that. So please be sure to fill out your raffle. So I'm just going to do a lucky dip there with the raffles, I guess. So far, any questions? Sorry. Oh, I'm just going to use your evals as the raffle tickets. So any other questions? Unconference event, raffles, anything else? Okay. With that, Mark, you're all set.
Thanks.
So, can everybody hear me? Is my mic on? I guess I sound good. So, by way of introduction, my name is Mark Kotke. I'm a principal consultant with Microsoft Services. And my career has been in helping customers build enterprise applications, and I work here out of the Bellevue office of Microsoft Consulting Services. So I might have worked with some of you on projects over the last many years, actually, that I've been with Microsoft. For a little over a year, I've been working with the Windows Azure Product Group, working with our testing and adoption program, which is the early adopter program that we have for bringing customers onto the platform prior to launch and testing out new features. Yeah, there's a question? Sure. Maybe there's a way to turn the mic up as well. Anyway. Oh. Okay. Does that sound better? Okay. So anyway, I've been working with the early adapter customers and with the first version of this TAP that we did, we started last May, and with the goal of getting customers ready to talk at PDC about their applications. So we had 27 customers we worked with, and many of the customers were, most of them were probably new applications, but a significant portion of them were migrations as well. So working on those customer applications through these migrations is kind of what has informed some of the things that I'll talk about. So as we go through this, really what I want you to get out of this is being able to think about how you want to plan your migrations, what are the things that are easy. I'll show you some of the easy stuff. David mentioned the question about moving an ASP.NET application. We'll go through that and talk about some of those issues, talk about some of the things that are difficult and what can you do about it. And so, you know, really when we look at the kind of applications that we've built with Windows Azure, we don't focus on migration, but one of the things that we really found with talking with the customers at PDC when we were in the show floor there is, you know, many were very interested in talking about migration. So I want to talk a little bit about the motivation for migration. I'm going to tell you, just briefly go over some of the customers that we did migrations with and kind of some of the high points of those migrations. And then we'll talk about different ways to think about an application migration. And then we'll go ahead and go into I've got a few demos I want to go through. We'll talk about some of the stuff that both David Robinson alluded to earlier in the day, a couple of things that David Akin talked about, and show you some of those things and some of the other things that happen across your life cycle, and then we'll wrap up. And I'd encourage you to interject with questions, because I'm not really a professional speaker, and I don't know if I can really keep it up for an hour and a half, so I need some input back from you guys. So anyway, why migrate? Really, the bottom line to all this is that the motivation for migration is the same as the motivation to build a new application. Just the flexibility that you get from the cloud and the computing power, all that, those are the same migration reasons for migration. And particularly, you know, you think, well, if I'm interested in moving to the cloud and I want to get at it quickly, well, really, the migration should be my quickest path to success, right? Because, you know, the code's already written. I don't have to go think up a new application. I don't need to negotiate with the business to try to figure out, you know, what they need and what the nail down the business rules. All these things are taken care of. So theoretically, you know, doing a migration should be my simplest path. But there are some things that need to be thought about before just assuming that that's going to be the easiest path to your first Azure application. So we saw this slide when David talked, and he talked about each one of these patterns. And actually, if you listen to a lot of particularly marketing presentations from Microsoft on Azure, you'll see this deck. But really what this slide is talking about, from my perspective, is it's about the agility of the cloud. And it's not just, you know, the agility of capacity, but also the agility of the cost, of the development, of the access. So all these patterns boil down to being able to move up and down, get up quickly, take capacity away quickly. So that's kind of where the customers that we worked with were motivated. So now I'm going to talk about six of the customers that we looked at. And all of these have case studies, so you can go and read more about these. And if you watched, if you sat down and watched all of the videos from PDC, you probably will have seen all of these customers talked about. But Kelly Blue Book was one of the customers that I worked with. And you're probably familiar with their business. They have a website that you can go to and get information about vehicles and sales, that type of thing. They get 14 million hits a month, and they currently are implemented in two data centers, and it costs quite a bit to keep that second data center up, both the data centers. And so they were interested in, you know, hopefully being able to move away from that DC. And so they have an ASP.NET MVC application, SQL Server. They have a shared nothing type architecture. So they were able to accomplish this migration very quickly, really. They were one of our first customers to really embrace Azure. And so because of that, they actually started their migration before SQL Azure was available in its current form. So it took a little bit longer than might have otherwise. But this was a great story that we had. And you could actually see them in the keynote at PDC. AdSlot is another interesting. Yeah, question.
Did they do this as a trial, or are you saying if you go to Kelly Blue Book today, you hit the Azure thing?
If you go to Kelly Blue Book today, you might hit a site served by Azure. So what they have is they've essentially got three data centers now, two physical data centers that they own, and some servers that are in Windows Azure. AdSlot was another customer that we worked with, and they do a combinatorial auction site. And actually what's interesting about this is the bid now that David talked about is kind of along the same lines, because these were a customer who actually migrated their storage to Windows Azure Storage. And, you know, David talked about why that's, a valuable way to go. But it really, from our perspective, when we looked at applications that were migrations, not too many customers are really eager to migrate to Azure Tables because, you know, literally every application that's been built is going to be on a relational database. But this customer saw the benefit of moving to Azure Tables just from the lower compute or the lower cost of storage and the way that they work with their data in compute. And so when David Aiken talked about how they held the data in his BidNow application, it's very similar kind of strategies that AdSlot used, where data is held, same data held multiple ways so that it queries quickly, different entity types held in one table with the partition key so that they can access data, related data quickly. And so another thing that AdSlot did was they were some of the first customers to use Memcached, which we'll talk about later in the presentation as well. Ticket Direct. Somebody talked about these guys earlier. But they're interesting because they have a ticketing site. They compete sort of with Ticketmaster. They have very peaky loads. The interesting thing about their business model is that they keep the venues much more involved in the sales process. And so their sales pitch to those venues is that the venues get a much higher percentage of the ticket price. So they don't get as high a service charge as like Ticketmaster does. And anyway, so they have these high volume sales. And what they did that's interesting is, you know, they used SQL Azure. Their database schema that they used was very similar to what they were using in their previously built application, but they did implement a sharding pattern that they rolled up with their own code. And so then another one that we worked with that was an interesting, this RiskMetrics is an interesting story on a lot of levels because it was one of the applications that we did that had pushed the scaling, I wouldn't say boundaries, but it was one of the first ones that we scaled out broadly with Windows Azure. So this application, at the time of PDC, they'd scaled out to 2,000 nodes. And what they do is Monte Carlo analysis for financial calculations. And the nature of this kind of work is that the more calculations they can do, the higher quality output they can have. And so, as I said, this is an application that you can hear quite a bit about. But from the perspective of migration, the key part of their solution, really the IP that differentiates them, and you know, gives the business their value, is the part that does that Monte Carlo simulation, and that is a 32-bit DLL, and if it had to rewrite that, it really wouldn't have made sense to even move the solution to Windows Azure, but they took that core part and they moved that in. The rest of the application was really re-architected to work well in Windows Azure, but we'll talk a little bit about how they took that DLL into Azure as well. CSC, this is a legal solutions site, so it's kind of it's a solution that just kind of manages the law office, and it's a ASP.NET application with SQL Server backend, and this was another migration similar to Kelly Blue Book in that it was a full migration, and this is another app that went pretty quickly. This one, they had to re-look at how they did communication back to their on-premise data center, and they had to restructure the way they do caching. But beyond that, that migration went pretty quickly as well. And what's interesting about this CCH Wolters Kluwer is they're a large business with many different applications that they have. But for what they do with Azure is they have a sales tax engine that they use to integrate with ERP systems. And the way that it's currently sold is that it's a on-premise solution, and they either send out DVDs or customers download data updates so that they can get the frequent updates, because that's the sales tax is something that changes frequently by jurisdiction and things like that. And so by moving it to the cloud, they're able to provide a solution that customers don't need to manage that, and they don't need to manage the downloads, and they don't need to manage the software on site. And so they moved that to the cloud. This was interesting because it's a service migration, and the thing that was that I thought was pretty cool about this one is that they use this particular sales tax engine is written with a tool from CA called Plex, and it's a fourth generation language that generates .NET code. And so, you know, I really thought that given the complexity of how that works, you know, that it had dependencies that would make the migration difficult. But as a matter of fact, it actually did work quite well, went quickly. The thing that's interesting here is when you think about, I believe David Robinson said, the SQL Azure has a connection timeout. And so when you look at these kind of solutions where you're doing a migration, you don't have control over all of the code, they had to write a little shim layer to help it recover from connection timeouts, because it holds the connections open. SQL Azure will drop those connections, so you need to have those connections reestablished with if they go away. So when we look at those customers that did migrations, and when we think about how we approach a migration, kind of the first look you have about it, or the first way you think about it, is I take and I want to migrate the whole application. This is just kind of, you know, the first way you would think about this. And so you've got all of these things you need to consider. But like we mentioned with these customers, is that it's also very valid to think about this from a taking just a portion of the application and migrating it. So in this situation, you know, you might look at migrating a layer. So you've got a retail app, say an airline booking site, where you've got a lot of browse activity, and you want to be able to manage that traffic, but you don't want to deal with, say, all of the security or something like that. So you might be able to take and migrate just the presentation layer. We had a customer who did this. And so then some of the things that you might be able to do are, you know, set aside some of the cross-cutting concerns. So maybe, you know, you don't need to do quite as much logging, so you don't need to figure out those things. And the benefit to this is, you know, you can get the power of the cloud. You can get your development team up to speed on building cloud applications. You can get your processes, you know, modified to include the cloud processes. So this is one way to look at it. We talked about CCH, Wolters Kluwer, and they did a service migration. So similar kinds of things. You know, you might be able to defer security. So maybe you've got a trusted subsystem sort of model, so you don't have to authenticate all the users. You've just got to make sure you've got a secure connection to your service. So this is another way to look at migration. And you think of what we did with risk metrics, you could also think of that as a service migration. Then the last kind of layered migration that we looked at is a data source migration. So here, a customer I didn't mention, Mammut, is a European customer who provide, or it's ISV, that provides ERP solutions for small and medium-sized businesses in Europe, and they have an online backup solution as part of the overall solution they provide. And so the way that that works is that there's a client portion that picks up the changes, encrypts them, sends them to a server on the Mammoth data center, and then they were able to just change the data access portion of that server, and instead of storing it onto servers, disks in their data center, they were able to store it into Windows Azure Blob Storage. So they were able to quickly solve the problem of having to scale out that data center for their additional customer load. Another place where we see data source migrations is for applications that need to stand up new instances very quickly. And so it's easier to deploy just the executable of an application, but then having the database behind it such that it's highly available. So, you have use SQL Azure to make new instances of the data and still leave the database or the applications on site. So that was another way that we saw migrations happen. So the bottom line to all of this is that when you think of, you want to do a migration, you can take a look at the whole application and see if it makes sense to just take a portion of it. And as we saw with our customers in that first version of TAP, we did see, all of these patterns actually enacted. Then the last thing that I want to talk about before we start talking about code and getting into Visual Studio is just looking at the whole application lifecycle. When you migrate code, it can affect everything in the application lifecycle. So from an envisioning perspective, there may not be too much change that you have there. Really just the knowledge of how the cloud operates and what that you can and can't do. But then when you get into planning, one of the things that we saw is even though the costs of running applications in the cloud are significantly lower than running applications on site, the granularity of the way that the charges happen for the cloud generate a lot of interest in what exactly it's going to cost. And so we've kind of heard bits and pieces through various presentations, but you've got compute costs, you've got different costs for the different size of compute you use, you've got storage costs for the amount of storage you've got, for the transactions that you run, you've got storage costs for the bandwidth that you use. There's a difference for SQL Azure, you've got just the 1, 10, and 50 gigabyte size, but you don't have a transaction cost. When you use AppFabric, you've got connections, you've got bandwidth. So all of those things factor in, and you really need to look at those because you want to plan for those. The other thing to know when you think about building applications for the cloud is that when you sign up for an account, there are limits on how high you can scale, which are just quotas so that we don't have attacks where people sign up for an account and try to run 100,000 instances. So you need to plan for the perspective of just if I know I'm going to need 100 compute instances, I want to call support and tell them that I need to do that. And then, yeah.
When you were dealing with these customers and the migrations, uh-huh. How much of the discussion was around these costs and the granularity and getting their heads around that versus all of the other benefits or aspects of the offer?
None, because in the first version, what we were doing before PDC, the prices weren't out. I actually did get a lot of questions about, well, what are the prices going to be, but I had no idea. But now that the prices are out, there's a TCO calculator that's available. If you go to windowsazure.com, and I think well, I don't know where it is. If you send me an email, I can send you a link to it. But there's a TCO calculator where you can go in and you can estimate all this data. So, you know, I'm going to do this many transactions. I'm going to have this many instances running. And you can use that to help estimate costs. But the thing that it doesn't do for you is help you figure out how many transactions you're going to have. It tells you what your cost is going to be if you have that many transactions. So
I get that these people didn't have other costs in the beginning, but now that they've migrated or they have some usage of this cloud, are some of them experiencing sticker shock or that first build shock where they're like, oh my God, I had no idea it was going to be this. I actually looked at that TCO calculator as a customer and found it to be very intimidating from a startup perspective. Now I can imagine a Kelley Blue Book or one of these big customers could come and say, hey, $1,500 a month or whatever that TCO calculator spit out to me, it wouldn't be a big deal. But for a new business or a new venture starting out, have you encountered that?
We've encountered sticker shock from both sides. For potential customers who are used to running simple web pages on hosted services, then they find the price to be kind of high, but they're using a very kind of low function, something that's not doing as much for them as Windows Azure. When we talked to enterprise customers, I actually had two large ones, one an oil and gas company, another large manufacturer, who looked at the cost of compute and thought that it was amazingly expensive because of what their data centers charge their departments for having services on-premise. I'd agree with what you're saying about the TCO calculator and it being intimidating, because figuring out how to fill in the boxes is not straightforward at all. I mean, what you need to do to figure that out is to have a very good picture of how your application is going to be architected. And when you're starting out, you don't have that. Question back in the back. Not heard of that being something that's in the plans, but then again, I'm not in the middle of the planning process. Though when we have our panel, you can ask Steve about that. Or actually, another thing is there's a website, My Great Windows Azure Idea, which is the site that's run by the Windows Azure product planning team, and they seriously look at that, and they take what they see on there very seriously. So when you have ideas like that, you can, of course, send them to us, but getting them out there, because the thing that does for you is that other customers or potential customers who look at that can vote on those things. And so people who see that, or the product planning team, can see how popular an idea that is. So that's a really great way to give input to the team. Yeah.
We're on the topic. How about if you guys put the cost of your demo apps? If you put the cost on the app so we can look and see, hey, if we're running an app that would be similar to this, this is what it would cost us. Because we saw a lot of great demos today, and just knowing ahead of time what that would cost on a monthly basis might be another way for people to use it.
Yeah, that's actually a great idea, because we have apps like the one that David showed, and just being able to say, if I have this application and I have this kind of traffic to it, and here's what the cost would be, I think that's a great idea. So we'll see if we can get somebody to look at that. So here's a list of things that I'm gonna go talk about now. Data migration, talk about state management, app configuration, all these things. I'm gonna do a little demo, so kind of take pretty simple app through some of these things, and I'll see how that goes. So we had Brad talking about Windows Azure Storage. We had David Robinson talking about the SQL Azure. David Aiken talked about storage as well. So from the perspective of a migration, we have VM local storage. So on the computer instances, we have local storage that's there available while that instance is up. Depending on the size of that instance, whether it's a small, medium, large, or extra large, it has a different size of local storage, and it's great for temporary data items. It's a hard drive on the machine that you can use, and so it's there while you're up, and it goes away when you're down. You can implement shared cache, so specifically memcached, you can implement, and then you can use this for temporary volatile data items that you need to share across roles. And so this is something that you can do if you have that need. X-Drive, Brad talked about that. It's another way to have a drive, like a local drive on our machine. This, however, is durable across role instances being up and down. The thing that's interesting about this is, and I think that Brad pointed this out as well, but it's key to know, is that you can only have this attached for update to one role instance. So it really is like a durable local drive. You can do snapshots and connect those to multiple role instances. So if you have like a very large data set that you want to have quick access to for all your role instances they want to operate off of, then this is using the snapshots of X-Drive is a good way to do that. Azure Blobs. So I guess I put these little check marks on here, and the reason that I have it yellow is not because there's anything wrong with using it, but typically this is not the kind of data that you have in an application that's built now. So from a migration perspective, this is not something that we see used a lot. It is actually one of the key things that we see used in new applications. It's kind of one of the core pieces of the cloud that gets used a lot. But from a migration perspective, it doesn't come up as often. And again, for Azure Tables, as I mentioned before, because of the differences in how it works from relational data, from the perspective of migration, it frequently doesn't really match up well. So we don't see that as much. Where we do see it is in situations where there's like a particular table that is kind of dominates the size of a relational database, and a customer will remove that data from the relational database, stick it in an Azure table so that they can get that much lower cost for that, maybe use a smaller SQL Azure instance for their relational database. Yeah, question.
Azure Blobs and Tables in production outside the cloud?
No. The question was, is it possible to use Azure Blobs and Tables outside the cloud? And so you can certainly use the ones in the cloud from on-premise solutions, but the blobs and the tables will be in the cloud. You do have the local dev storage, which emulates that, but it's not something you would use for production. It's just for development. Then we talked about SQL Azure. This is SQL Azure. You know, what David Robinson said is that he'd feel like he was doing his job if you felt like you wasted your time when he's telling you about it. I'd agree. You know, the fidelity that they have for the pure relational part of SQL Server is great. Works really well. I've been very happy with when that came out. Really made our lives a lot easier for migrations, particularly. So you saw the size limits. The 50 gigabyte is not fully available right now, but it will be soon. So that addresses that. A much broader set of scenarios. However, there are a lot of solutions out there that do need even bigger than that. So those. You know, the you've got a problem to solve when you get to those very large data sets. And then I clicked before I talked about it, but SQL, MySQL, you can also do. There's a solution accelerator on the web that shows you exactly how to run MySQL instance on Windows Azure. And so I'm going to go into some of these tools. You've seen them all. Well, actually, you haven't seen all of them. You saw the Cloud Storage Studio, which David talked about. And I'll just emphasize what a great tool it is. It not only does it handle storage, but it also allows you to manage your services as well. From a data migration perspective, the one cool thing that I'll mention is that if you're looking to take data from SQL Server into Azure Tables, then it's got a facility to do that in a very straightforward way. You can manage your partition keys there. And the other thing that you can do with that is it allows you to work against views. So if you needed, say you're going to restructure your data going from SQL Server into Azure Tables, you can make a view and you can upload it into your Azure tables. And then for the SQL Azure, we've got the SQL Server 2008 R2 CTP Management Studio. David Robinson talked about that. It's got to be the R2, but I'm going to do a demo of that. And the SQL Azure Migration Wizard, I'm also going to show you that. So what I'm going to do is there's an application called the Nerd Dinner, which you might have seen. If you saw Jun Nakashima's Mix presentation, I heard that he demoed this. But I'm going to do that's the demonstration that I'm going to do. And I am going to do something a little bit different than what I believe he did. This application is something that's on CodePlex, and it's written by Scott Hanselman as an example for using the ASP MVC framework. And if you download it from CodePlex, then what you get is an application that works against SQL Express. So to make this a more of an enterprise-like demonstration, I've moved the databases to SQL Server. So I'll show you SQL Server. This application has two databases. It's got the ASP.NET provider database and a Nerd Dinner database. And so I'm going to do each of these a different way. So I'm going to take this, the ASP.NET provider database, and I've just gone to generate scripts. I'm going to generate the whole database from a script. What I have to do here to get this compatible with SQL Azure is go here to the script for the database engine type. And see, I can select SQL Azure database. And so, you know, this manages all those differences as there are, even though there is high fidelity between the two, there are differences. So this handles things like there's changes in the way clustered indexes are enforced, and there's some of the older styles of Transact SQL it doesn't like. And so this manages most of those. So I've selected that. And also here, I want to take schema and data. So I'm just going to save the script now.
Let's add the SQL Express database from Hanselman's app, and you're scripting it out for the cloud?
No, what I said is his application, if you get it straight from CodePlex, goes against SQL Express. I moved it to SQL Server to make the application, to make this demonstration more real.
SQL Server on-prem, now you're scripting from there to get a cloud-compatible database.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
So I'm taking this from my local SQL Server. Another question in the back?
Does SQL Azure support the 2008 page compression? For index
I don't know. maybe if, when we have our panel, if we can, if some of the other folks are here, you can ask that question again, or send it to me in email. I can also answer it then. So anyway, then what I'm doing is I'm taking it again from my local SQL server, full SQL Server 2008 instance, and I'm scripting that. So it just runs through the script real quick here. This is a small database, so it won't take very long. So I finish that. And now up here in the top, I have connected to my SQL Azure database. And so what I'm going to do is just create a new database there. And I'll call it FSASPProv. Execute that, create that database. So now I've got this new database here. And I'm just going to go open that script file that I just created. That one. You see, I proxied that a couple of times. Execute that. That'll just run for 13 seconds or so, I think. And then that database will be ready to go. So I did something wrong here. Okay, just let me check this real quick. Well, let's just go through this again, because this... So I'm just going to drop that database. Let's regenerate this script. Actually, I forgot to do this part here. Yeah. Change my database? No, I don't have to do it. To the database I'm exporting out of? No. Shouldn't have to.
Yes.
He asked if it could be done through SQL CMD. So you can do this from a command line or any way that you can just connect with that connection string. So now we've created this database. I've got my schema in there and the data. And so one of the things that I wanted to show you that David Robinson mentioned but didn't talk about in detail is when I scripted that data, it put all the data in that database script. And if I have a very large database, having the rows of my data won't be performant at all. It'll take, even with a small database like a gigabyte database, it will take a long time for it to come up. And so I think right around PDC when SQL Azure first went production, they added support for BCP. And so this SQL Azure Migration Wizard is something that was written by George Huey, who's an architect evangelist with DPE, Methuen's organization. And what this does is not only do you get the source code of it and you can modify how it operates, but this thing generates BCP as well. So for databases that are larger, this really is the only way to go unless you want to script it yourself. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to connect to my database. So you can see that here I've got the same set of databases that you can see right here. And I'm going to pick that Nerd Dinner database and go through here. And I'm just going to take the defaults. And so this is a tiny database, so this won't take long to generate the script at all. But this also makes the changes for the differences for between the on-premise and the SQL Azure database. And it's created a script now. And then the next thing I need to do is to connect to my SQL Azure instance. So here I've got my portal for SQL Azure. I'm going to copy my database name. Paste that in there. And then it offers me the databases that are there. I can create a new database. So I'm going to go ahead and create a new database, ND Fire, we'll call it. Create that database and run the script against it. So now we've got our two databases. Yeah, question. No, but you can modify the database to make a 10 gigabyte data with a script. So you can extend the size of the database. That's actually a feature they added to SQL Azure not too long ago. It wasn't long ago that when you had a 1 gigabyte database, the only thing you could do is get the data out and then build a 10 gigabyte database and put the data back in. But I'm not sure exactly when it was, but they did make it possible to go from a 1 to a 10. So with that, we'll go back to the slides and see what we want to talk about next. Caching and state management. So a bunch of different options here. In any given application that you've gotten built, a lot of different ways you might be handling this, different ways that you might want to deal with data. So a lot of you, I imagine, are familiar with Velocity, the distributed cache that is part of the App Fabric server. As you may have heard, it's not yet available in Windows Azure. I don't have the roadmap, but one day it will be available, but it's not today. So ASP.NET cache, that can be used in Windows Azure for an individual instance. The thing that doesn't work there is the cache dependencies. So if you've used the ASP.NET cache and know how it works, you can cache data and you can have the dependency on other objects. That part doesn't work. Page output caching is similar. session state. I think David Aiken mentioned this, but you know the way that you do session state on your in-premise server, on-premise servers, is you've got three different things you can do: in proc, state server, and SQL server. So in proc works fine, but it doesn't work across servers. So there's a couple of different implementations you can have. There's a set of samples that ship with the Windows Azure SDK that implement the ASP.NET providers. And that sample uses a combination of table storage and blob storage. On CodePlex, there's a sample that uses SQL Azure for session state. And we've used both of those. Actually, we've done one other thing in TAP customers, although I don't have a sample to give out. But another approach you can take is down here towards the bottom, or second from the bottom, is Memcached. And that's a open source distributed cache implementation. And this is the distributed cache that we typically use in Windows Azure solutions. And it's fairly straightforward once you've got that working to use that as the backing store for your session state. So that's an approach you can take. Profile properties, going back to where I was, again, there's a sample there with the ASP.NET providers. Application state, that all works the same as you would expect it. Client-side approaches, all the other things, you know, cookies, hidden fields, that kind of thing, all would work as you expect. Talked about Memcached. David Aiken talked about the content delivery network. So that's what gives you the ability to have your blob storage spread across those 18 data centers and be highly available and faster access for your customers that are dispersed. And then, of course, Azure Storage you can use to build any kind of state management caching that you find necessary or any custom solutions that you've got. So now when you look at how your applications are configured, that when you deploy to Windows Azure, your application is packaged up into a single file that's zipped and encrypted. And in that package, you know, the service definition, so the thing that defines all the different kind of roles that you have in your application, the web config, app config, any custom configuration files that you have are all packaged up into that file. And so the difference that you have now is that those things are in a place where you can't change them, whereas in your on-premise solutions, you know, you expect to be able to go in and into your file system, change those things, and have them affect your file or your system. So external to that package is the service configuration. So there's a file, CFG, that has the Windows Azure configuration. So typically, things that need to be available for change at runtime need to be moved into there. Another thing you can do, of course, is you can put them in external storage. So you could store them in, well, any other storage system you have. So Azure Tables or SQL Azure, you could store there. But kind of the common scenario is to store it in the service configuration. And so when you do that migration, the thing that you want to think about is, of all that stuff that's in your app config or your web config, how much of that stuff is really things that you need to change while the application is deployed? Some of it is version dependent, so you don't really need to move it because, you know, you're only going to change it when you change versions. Other stuff, you know, you may want to indeed move it to the Windows Azure configuration. And then you can get that in application startup and move it into the app config so that you don't have to change the whole process within the application. A couple other things to know about configuration is when the configuration is changed, the configuration file, the CSCFG, is changed, it will fire this role environment changing event in your web roles, and so, or web or worker roles, and then you can catch that event, and if you cancel the event, then it will restart the instances. So, in other words, if your system doesn't respond well to in-flight changes to configuration, then you can cancel that event. It will shut down the instance, and then it will restart and pick up those new configuration when it starts up again. And then there's a role environment.changed event as well that fires after the event, after the configuration has changed. You can't encrypt the data, or the ASP.NET process for encrypting data in your web config is not supported. When you package your applications for deployment, those are encrypted, and that data is protected. If you need to actually encrypt the data further in either your configuration or within the roles, then you can use, you know, the crypto API, things like that, to encrypt data. A couple other things to note. If you have applications that need to be aware of whether they're running in the cloud or not, you have role environment.is available to use. And then because of the way that IIS is implemented, the application underscore begin request isn't, you use the begin request as opposed to application start to do things like make those configuration moves from the Azure configuration file to your app config. So now let's take the next step on this application. So I'm going to go to Visual Studio. And so this is the application. And what you see here that's changed from what you would get if you downloaded it from CodePlex is I took out the unit tests. So when you see this application from CodePlex, it'll have unit test project in here as well. And the other thing that it has is that the SQL Express databases that I talked about. But again, I moved those to my on-premise SQL server, so that's not there. So other than that, it's unchanged. So now the first thing that we need to do is to add a cloud project to this. So I'll just call this FireCloud. And I don't need to add any roles to this because I've got this application in my project that I'm going to use as the web role here. So now I've got a cloud project, but I don't have any role instances. So I go in here, I can say new web role in project. And that picks up the project that I've got here and adds it to my cloud project. And so if we look at that, then I talked about the service definition being in the package. This is the service definition file. It says I have a web role. It's got the input endpoint and diagnostic connection string. And then this is that configuration file that I was mentioning. So the next thing that I want to do, actually, so if this was a very simple, the simplest of web applications, then this is actually all I'd have to do. If this didn't have any connections to anything else, I could deploy this and, you know, it would run. So if this is just a collection of web pages, that's all I'd have to do. This is got more going on in it. So first thing that I want to do is add references to some of the assemblies that are part of the Windows Azure API. So I'm adding the Windows Azure.diagnostic service runtime and storage client. Actually, didn't need to add storage client because storage client is the thing that helps me access Windows Azure storage, which I'm not going to use in this application. Service runtime is the assembly that essentially helps me manage the instance. So it's the thing that I inherit from my my web roles, that type of thing. The diagnostics are what hooked me into that diagnostic system. So we're going to go back to the presentation here for a moment. We'll come back to this one more time. That application, next time we come back, we'll actually make it run. So other thing that you're typically going to find when you move an application to the cloud is you're going to need to take a look at how you're exposing your services. So if I go into Visual Studio Project and I start a web app or a cloud application and I go through and I see the different kind of roles it offers me, it offers me the opportunity to create a WCF web role. And if I do that, it gives me a HTTP WCF service in a web role instance. I can also implement WCF services in worker roles, and when I do that, then I have the ability to also expose TCP endpoints. Either way, these will go through the load balancer and be exposed out to the internet. So that's all goodness. That's something that we definitely certainly know that we need to be able to support. However, if I've got a layered application, then chances are I don't want that those services exposed to the internet. I want to be able to only interact with them with my services. So for that, we have inter-role communication. And what this allows me to do is define endpoints that are only exposed within my set of services, my different role instances that I have in my cloud application. And so what's different about that is, again, they're not exposed to the internet. They're not load balanced. And I need to call the set of Windows Azure APIs to discover what those services, the IPs are and the ports and things like that. So then I wire that up once the service is actually running. And this is important for scenarios like when we run Memcached, because we have a bunch of different services that we need to point to individual ones. So some of the things that we need to think about when we are building these different WCF scenarios are wiring up those endpoints that we discover at runtime to those endpoints that I have. A couple of kind of idiosyncrasies about how you create the proxies for Azure. If I've got a WCF service that's built and I just add a proxy to the in a Visual Studio application, you get an error. There are, if you go to this URL that I've got here, you'll find links to the hot fixes from the WCF team that fix that. But essentially, it's a load balance behavior that that hot fix fixes. A couple other things are you can run the roles in partial trust. Actually, there's an option which is enable trusted connection, I think. I can show it to you when I do the demo. But you need to run your applications in full trust in order to get the bulk of the WCF functionality. And then the other thing is for a lot of enterprise scenarios, you want to think about using Service Bus because it enables more of the scenarios for kind of the more secure and being able to get you through the firewalls into the enterprise environments. Another thing to think about here are the real legacy kind of DLL. So you've got comm applications, which typically have a dependency on the registry, which you only have the ability to update a small portion of the registry. And so there's a way to interact with COM components with manifest files. So that's a pattern that we've seen a couple of times. And then also 32-bit DLLs. When all the Windows Azure roles are 64-bit, and so you can run 32-bit processes on a 64-bit machine, but what you can't do is call 32-bit DLLs from a 64-bit process. And so in order to use these 32-bit DLLs, what you end up having to do is write a 32-bit process, exe, that calls the 32-bit DLLs, expose that with WCF on that instance itself, typically expose it with like a name pipes interface, because you're going to call it from your worker role or web role instance, and then that's how you can kind of broker that 64-bit to 32-bit process. When you do that with these with those external processes, you host those, you fire that up with a new process, and then you block to leave that thing running while you're interacting with it. And you can redirect the output to the Windows Azure Diagnostics if you want to get that diagnostic information. So when you think about how you do debugging and diagnostics in the cloud, I think we kind of touched on some of these things earlier, but bottom line to this is, you know, you're used to being able to walk up to the machine, get to the desktop of it, get at any of the logs, the event log, the performance monitor, all that kind of thing. When you're in the cloud, you've got multiple instances, you've got distributed transactions, you can't get to the machine itself. So, you know, how do you do that? So Windows Azure has the diagnostic API, which allows you to get access to all these different things. So now we'll talk about this process. And David talked about this as well. So I'll show you kind of a different view of it, I guess. But by default, the trace logs, infrastructure logs, and IIS logs are enabled. And you can get that through the diagnostic API, Trace Listener, and that they go into either tables or blobs, depending on the type of data that you're getting. So how this works is when you fire up your instance, whether it's a web or worker role, you start the diagnostic monitor with some configuration. And that tells the diagnostic monitor what pieces of information that you want to get. Then as that data is collected, it's stored in VM local storage. Actually, the pieces of information that come directly from the running of your role instance go from your role to VM local storage. The other items that we have in the purple box are things that are not directly tied to your role instance, but they're operating system things. So the diagnostic monitor collects those and puts those into local storage. And then at a scheduled transfer time, it will move those to Azure storage. So you can use those, the tables and the blobs, to see that information. When you see tools like what David showed, and things like the Azure Diagnostic Monitor from Sarah Brada, those look at these tables and blobs to get that information. These things you can change at runtime as well. There's configurations held in blob storage that tells it what performance counters to catch, what logs. So the cool thing about this is, you know, not only do you configure it when you start it, but you can reconfigure it at any time as you need to. Again, this is all done through APIs, so it's not as straightforward out of the box as it could be, but there's a lot of tools that are being built up around this to make it a lot more seamless. So a couple of things to note are that, you know, as you store this data in tables and blobs, the storage costs apply. So, you know, if you're generating lots of logs, then, you know, this is particularly an area that can that you can grow large. So you want to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, you're doing something that is going to cost you money. So you want to look at how you're managing that. So let's go ahead and finish up my little app here. So what I need to do is do the one thing that I forgot to do last time. I've got a couple of files here that I need to add. So this connection strings is the file that I've got this connection strings to my the database. And so I need to change this because I changed the database that I'm pointing at. And again, this thing is referenced in my web config, and it's not part of the project. So what I need to do is go add this to the project so it gets included in the package. So when it gets deployed, it'll be there. The other thing that I'm going to do while I'm in here is I'm going to grab this webroll.cs. So that webroll.cs, well, actually, let's change this real quick. So this is the connection string that connected to my local database. And I, as luck would have it, I have one here that is pointed to the cloud. I just need to change it to the databases that I created. So, I called this AAASP.net. And ND Fire. So that's changed now. Let's take a look at this. So this webroll.cs file that I added here is exactly the webroll.cs that I would have gotten had I just went and created a new cloud project with a new cloud with a web role. And so what this does is it adds a class called web role that inherits from role, that, role entry point. Here I start the diagnostic monitor, as I mentioned. And then it also adds this role environment.changing event so that I can grab this event and cancel it, like I mentioned earlier, so that it'll restart this role instance when I, if that configuration changes. And then the last thing that I need to do to this application is I want to go in, and I mentioned the trace, and what I've got here is I'm adding in that trace listener that is connected to the Windows Azure Diagnostic Monitor. And so now, if I do that, I can run this in my development storage or development fabric running against SQL Azure. And so actually, I'm a little getting a little tight on time here, but it'll start up quick. I just won't do much with it. So if we look at what I did here, you can see that if had I not gone through all the explanation, this would have been like a, you know, 5-10 minute change. So when you think about all the different things that we didn't do, you know, there's a lot of I didn't have any connectivity to an enterprise solution, you know, back in my corporate environment, that type of thing. So there are a lot of things that I might have to change, but I think I. Actually, I don't have any data in here. but just to prove that it is saving something. Well, so this application would is now saving its data to SQL Editor. We could publish this and deploy it to the cloud, and it would work just fine. So let's move on real quickly. So we talked a little bit about the deployment life cycle and how that's affected. So had we taken this to the next step, what we would have done is we would have packaged the app. So we would have right-clicked and we would have done publish, which packages all of the application up into an encrypted file. It has all the binaries. And then we also have the CS config file, which we deploy. When we deploy, we can either go to the development portal and we can point to a location on my local drive and deploy the file, the package file and the config file, push it up there, or I can take those and I can put them into blob storage and then deploy them from blob storage. We always recommend that that you load them to blob storage and deploy from there, because one of the other things that I'm not sure that we mentioned in this venue, but when your application is loaded, when it's in loaded to a service within Windows Azure, if it's deployed to a service, then you're being charged for it. So when it, if it's not, even if it's not running, you still are being charged for it. So so you need to delete it if you don't need it running, if you don't want to be charged for it. So the typical pattern we have is you deploy it to, or you load it to blob storage, and then when you want to run it, you deploy it and then run it. Once it's run, you can do various things with it. You can configure it, so you can use the portal to change configuration, or you can upload configuration, and it goes through that process of the firing those events. You can promote the application. I'll talk about that in just a second, so I won't go into that right now. You can do upgrades of it. So what you can do there is you can upload a new version of your application, and you can do upgrades in place so that while the thing is still running, you can do an upgrade, and it'll go through the upgrade domains. So I believe that was mentioned a little bit earlier today as well, but essentially you've got, when you've got those different instances, they're sitting in different upgrade domains so that the application upgrades can be rolled across there. And if you want us to understand that in a fair amount of detail, if you send me mail, one of the PMs on the team just posted a nice blog entry that really explains this well. It's one of the best explanations I've seen. So you send me an email, I can send you a link to that. And then you can suspend and delete it. So when you think about, when you do that, I got these considerations on here. I believe David showed picking a particular data center. So you've got affinity groups you can define to say that I want to group my services and storage into an affinity group so that they'll stay in a single data center. You want to make sure that you keep your deployments within a data center because the performance is typically noticeable. And so MS build, TFS build integration. When you look at those, the PowerShell command list, the service management API, those are the ways that you integrate with the TFS. This is actually, it's pretty straightforward doing that integration. And then when you're looking at deployment and how you manage your life cycle and how you compare it to what you're doing now with your different environments, when you create a new service with Windows Azure, you get two slots, essentially, and they're referred to as a staging slot and a deployment and a production slot. And there's no functional difference between how these two work. The one difference is when you create your service, you give it a name, firestarter.cloudop.net, and that's what your production slot will be. Your staging slot will have some GUID.cloudop.net. And so when you have those, what you can do if you deploy to staging, you can do a publish and it'll move it, do what is referred to as a VIP swap, to move it into production. And the significance of that is that you get a IP address, your public IP address for your service, which you'll get on your staging environment. And when you do that publish, that IP address doesn't change, but your DNS is actually your firestarter.cloudop.net. So there's no requirement that you do this, but that's one way to have that be remain available across that that moving from staging to the production. Another common pattern that we see, because you know, that particular process is not always exactly how you want it to work. A lot of times most times, really, you've got configuration changes you need to do between, you know, a test environment to your production environment. So many of our customers who have, you know, a more sophisticated deployment pattern use two services. So they'll have one that they use, so on the what we refer to as first deployment here, which is where you do your testing and you verify the solution works. And then you've got another service which you upload your service that is destined to be production. It's got all the production configuration. You do whatever burn-in testing you need to do to verify that the new configuration items work. And then when you're ready to turn it loose to actually make it production, then you do the publish to the production, and now it'll be available with your production name that you've got for it, your firestarter.cloudout.net. And then the other thing that we kind of wanted to mention on the development process is kind of the typical way that we go through this is that we start our development with development fabric against development storage. Although I will say that when we're using SQL Azure, we typically go directly against SQL Azure, just because there's enough small differences between on-premise that it's just easier to go directly to SQL Azure. But anyway, point being, we start with development fabric because that's where your debugging is the most robust. Then the second stage is to move your storage to the cloud, whether it be Azure Tables or SQL Azure, still debugging with development fabric. Then once that's you're convinced that those tests are working, then move the solution into the cloud. So kind of talked about the various pieces and parts you have of the application lifecycle and how each of these things are affected. I guess one thing that I didn't mention and is actually critical, actually there's two things that I should bring up. For identity federation, didn't talk about that at all, but that's a critical topic that you are going to deal with when you do migrations, and because typically it's going to be some sort of enterprise application. And the good news, since I didn't talk about this, is that this topic is pretty well discussed. It was well discussed at PDC. So if you need information about that, you can send me mail, or you can look just on Channel 9, you can see Vittorio Bertacci. He's got a whole series about this. There's a Windows Identity Training Kit. So even though we didn't cover it here, it's well covered. It's a critical topic for migration particularly. So that's something you want to consider. The other thing that I'd mention too is that David mentioned a little bit the various capabilities we have for open source both development and migration. We've actually seen quite a few applications or Java applications that were migrated to Windows Azure. Domino's Pizza was a case study that you'll see talked about quite a bit. There's a Java application. Another one, if you look at the links that I had a link in there for the CSE application. The link in there takes you to an article that's about three different solutions that were built. One of those other ones is Infosys, and they have a mobile app that was a Java application. So I guess the best way to do that is also, if you're interested in those things, send me mail, because there's quite a few accelerators that have been built, I believe, are on Code Gallery for MySQL, for PHP, for Eclipse, Tomcat, a lot of different open source tools that you might want to use. So those are all available as well. So anyway, hopefully, you know, you've got a picture of some of the customer successes we saw, some of the things that you want to think about, different ways to look at migration, and then, you know, some of the details of how you go about it. And hopefully, you're also ready to move your application over. Here's some related stuff, links to some of the things that I talked about today. And, you know, again, if you have questions about any of this, then you can send me an email. Or actually, I believe now it's time to have a panel discussion.
Thanks, Mark.